Well, Vic came in too.
Oh. Joe and I are doing a coin toss.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to this interim meeting of the Interim Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development. Today is Monday, September 16th. And it's hard to believe that it's only been 2 months since I've seen you all. Actually, you should all look older because it's 2 months later, and yet you all look younger than you did the last time I saw you, so it's great. Welcome, members of the audience. Yes, Rep. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I just want, on behalf of the committee, I just want to thank you for securing another one of these early morning time slots. I know we speak for all the committee members.
Thank you
for your diligent efforts to keep us on time and punctual and up early.
You're quite welcome. To be honest, I had you in mind, Rep. Johnson, when I moved the time from 8 to 8:30, knowing that that would just barely satisfy you. Anyway, thank you all for coming so early. This is the beginning of, you know, for us, 3 days of a lot of committees, a lot of different task forces and meetings. And I know the same is true for some of you out there, so welcome. I'm going to start off with, we have to adopt our committee rules, so I'm going to open an organizational meeting of this committee for the purpose of adopting committee interim rules. Vice Chair Huffman.
Chair D'Ambrosio, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules.
Vice Chair Huffman moves to adopt the interim committee rules. Is there any discussion? Yes, Rep. Wiseman.
Did Representative Huffman read them and he recommends them?
I'm sorry?
Did Representative Huffman read them and does he recommend we approve them?
Boy, we do have high standards.
Chair D'Ambrosio, I move to adopt the.
Yes, just
quickly,
colleagues, the rules are, you know, pretty standard. I will just point out that, you know, what will culminate from this interim process will be most likely three committee bills. That's what we're allowed. You know, I think that we're probably going to have a priority for those task forces that, you know, have been charged by the committee if in case they have any legislation that they're recommending. But it may be that we have one or two, who knows, other committee bills available. So I would like you to be thinking of, if you have any recommendations, it would be good if we could know them by the November meeting, because our deadline, and let me turn over to Victoria, could you remind us of what the dates are? And just to remind you, we each get two individual bills, and then each committee gets three bills.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The dates for submission to Legislative Council of all concepts is November 26th. Legislative Council will have all LCs returned by January 13th, 2014, and all LCs must be dropped by January 21st, 2014.
Okay. I'm sorry. I haven't had coffee, but it goes again. I got November 26th.
November 26th is the date that must be submitted. They'll have LCs returned by January 13th of 2014, and then they must be dropped by January 21st of 2014.
Question, Chair?
Yes, Representative.
You've indicated that we have three, but does the Chair going to, do you have recommendations now, or you propose, or are you going to wait, let us?
You know, I think we have to see what's going to come out of the task forces. If, you know, we have several that we've authorized, and, you know, some of them may require legislation in February, others not. You know, I think I'd like to have a deadline for that, too, of November for the task forces to let us know so that we can make a decision. Rep. Johnson, do you have a question?
Just a clarifying question. So the rules we're adopting are simply prior to February, right? Because we have other rules for February that govern our conduct there.
That's right.
Correct. Thank you.
Yeah. You know, if you recall, what we did last time was we actually started having hearings in the January interim meeting. And, you know, I personally, I hope we do that again, because that allowed us to really hit the ground running in February. Remember, we have like a week's turnaround in February. That special session is so focused and intense. The more we can come in prepared, the better. So. Any other questions or comments?
The rules don't say we're meeting at 8:30. Can we put 9 o'clock?
How about 10? 10 a.m.
Compromise. Bipartisan.
Yeah, there you go.
We're holding hands across the aisle.
Well, colleagues, we'll see how we do today. I will not rule out our meeting at 8 next time. But if we proceed through this meeting very precipitously, then maybe we'll feel confident with an 8:30 start again. All right. Is there any further discussion? Is there any objection to our adopting these rules? Okay, seeing none, the rules are adopted. I'll close the organizational meeting, and we will begin our informational meeting. Colleagues, we have a series of presentations today. Many of them, again, in the form of updates from work that we ended when we met last. Things have been continuing. Some exciting developments have been happening, I'm happy to say. We'll hear about them today. We'll also be focusing on the recent Secretary of State audit, which came out, I think, while we were still in session, but right at the end. No, maybe not. It was after. Anyway, we'll be spending a bunch of time on that. So let's start off. It's my pleasure to call up Nancy Golden, our interim chief education officer. Many of you will remember Nancy from her time as the governor's policy advisor back in the 2011 session, where she and we suffered together, but also accomplished a lot. I see Hilda Roselli as well, and both of them are going to tell us what's going on with the Oregon Education Investment Board. Nancy, welcome.
Thank you. Representative Dembrow, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Nancy Golden, interim chief education officer. So the other thing that I've been doing in the last, since Senate Bill 909 passed, which gave us the authority to start the Oregon Education Board, is I've been the alternate chair for the governor, so I've been deep in the work, and it's really a pleasure to get back here as the interim chief education officer to help work side by side with you to move the work forward. So,
thank you. We're really happy to have you in this role. Mm-hmm. Springfield School District's loss, but it is the state of Oregon's gain.
Thank you so much. So I'm going to be talking from a document that looks like this. You should all have a copy, and I think it's going to be put up there. And I want to begin by just saying what you'll see in this document is just a vision of the Oregon Education Investment Board. And then after that, we always are looking at everything through the equity lens. The equity lens was passed last year by the Oregon Education Investment Board. It's been interesting since I've assumed this role. One thing people continuously ask me, so what exactly does the OEIB do? So I figured it was time for a little clarity about that. So basically, we do three things. The first thing is develop the seamless system of P, and by that we mean prenatal to 20. We manage the transitions in the P20 system, and we work to overcome barriers. And then the last thing we do is we make recommendations about investment for the governor's budget or to legislators. So those are the key three things that we do. But in order to do that, there's a lot of work, much of it which came from legislators who passed certain laws to help us make sure we complete this. And, of course, this is all to achieve the 40-40-20 goals by 2025. So I wanted to talk a little bit about creating the P20 system. I know you've all heard much about achievement compacts, maybe more than you want to hear. But what we can tell you is that the achievement compacts for higher ed are in, and we spent a lot of time this summer just talking about how do we really analyze them so the data will be really useful in helping us think about the P20 system and where are there barriers and how do we overcome those barriers. So in addition to that, we just allocated resources, one of our investments, for 12 regional achievement collaboratives. We're very excited about the collaboratives because the feedback we'd been getting when we were just doing achievement compacts, a lot of people felt perhaps it was another bureaucratic thing we had to fill out, another bureaucratic form. But once we started meeting P20 and started working as systems in our communities, it really started to take a life that was really, really meaningful. I was part of the Lane County, what's called Connected Ed Collaborative, and the work we did together was probably the most important meeting I ever went to every month. And I would say when I left Springfield, we had three times as many students going to the University of Oregon from Springfield School District than ever before, and I think that's because when you start working across the levels, you break down the barriers, you care about the targets at each other's level. So we're holding a lot of hope for these collaboratives, and there's 12 of them that were funded. So, and if anyone wants to know, I have the names of all of those. The second thing that's really critical is the P20 longitudinal system, and as you know, we're doing a data case that was asked of us to do. And I want to just introduce who's here to do the data case, because I think when you see his expertise, you'll have great confidence that we really can have a great data case to the legislators by the short session. So this is Peter Trumba. He's sitting right there. And some of you might know Peter Trumba because he was on the Quality Ed Commission. But one thing, here's some background about Peter. He built a computer when he was 10. He's a lot more people do that now, but then it was kind of rare. Mm-hmm. He laid a wide area network, a local area network. I don't know, was it, who was it for, the Army, who was it when you did that?
Albany School District.
Oh, Albany School District. Well, more important than the Albany. Mm-hmm. Okay. In addition to that, he's programmed routers. Then he went and he was the technology director of Albany School District. That's where we first met. But after that, he went on and he became a high school principal and a middle school principal. And now he's the technology director for 4J School District, on leave for us for the year to make sure we get the data case and the longitudinal database launched. So you can see he's got a unique set of experience of being a teacher, being in schools, and also the technical knowledge that I think is needed to really make sure we deliver on this expectation. So that's a little bit about Peter. I know he'll be wanting to talk to all of you so that he can accomplish the deadline to me of December 15th so I can get it to you by the timeline that is necessary. In addition to that, one of the things I started as soon as I came in this position was to create a P20 council. And so on this P20 council, we have people from Early Learning, JADA, and from ODE, Rob Saxton. We have Gerald from Community College Commissioner, Iris from Wide Youth Development, as Ben Cannon, and the OEIB members. And what we're really doing is meeting every 2 weeks, sort of like the collaboratives, to make sure we're thinking about the whole P20 system and that we are knocking down any of the barriers that exist in the system. We've had 2 meetings so far. I think they've been really great. We're talking about really important things like the 12th grade year and how do we get students to get more college credit in the 12th grade year and how do we get students to go to school more in the 12th grade year, because a lot of them end up going 2 periods. So very important conversations when we work with you on all those important issues. So now I'm in the second column, which is aligned governance, and I'll only talk a little bit about that because Ben Cannon's going to be with you later, and he certainly can talk more about that. But we want to talk about the expanded head staff and responsibilities. And when I first came, I had an opportunity to thank the group of people who had been working with HEC for their great work. And you know, today there'll be a Senate approval of the new HEC members. So we're excited about that. And there's also been a recommendation for the executive director of the HAC to the governor, and I anticipate within 10 days he'll have a decision about who he's going to be putting in that position. So, and what you'll see under there are a number of the key initiatives that we'll be working on, that the HAC will work on. I want to talk about just a few of them. Credit for prior learning, that's a very exciting, I think, initiative. And what's happening now is that there's draft standards that are going to be vetted in the field so that we can make sure we have the input that's necessary when you implement something new like that. Another thing that we're all very excited about is the Common Core number and numbering system. And I know as a parent who sent a child to college and after 1 year she transferred to another school and needed to repeat much of that year, mm-hmm. that I think this is going to be wonderful for all of the people who have students in college to have sort of seamless transfer that really minimizes the waste in terms of repeating courses. In addition to that, we know that we want to make a system that's intuitive and transparent, particularly for our first-generation students. So we're very pleased about that. At the last OEIB meeting, the OEIB did ask the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, the HAC, to take a look at the opportunity grants and to look at it in terms of, but not limited to, retention, completion, time to degree, and employment in degree-related fields. So that is going to be part of the HAC, too. Another important initiative is the pay forward, pay backward, and I bet you're all experiencing this, but we've been getting many calls in the office wanting to know what Oregon's doing. It's looked as a very forward-thinking initiative, and so it's going to be very, very important as we move forward with that to see how can we create secondary opportunities for all of our students, which is much less costly, maybe freezes tuition, and really allows more undergraduate students to really see higher education as something that they can realize. Ben will talk to you about the rest in terms of the governance, but I do want to talk a little bit about the Network for Quality Teaching and Learning. We all know, I would tell you as a school superintendent at that time when we heard about the allocation, the $45 million for quality teaching and learning, I think so many of us just felt like that was such a terrific thing for all of us who are working in the field. So thank you for that, and I want to talk a little bit about some of the exciting pieces of it. I mean, we all do know that by 2020, a third of our Oregon teachers are going to be gone, and we also know that the diversity of our students is very different than the workforce, the teachers who work with our students, and we're very committed to closing that gap. And so in order to do that, one of the allocations was to provide scholarships and clear pathways for students who want to become educators. I'll say in Springfield, we have a program that's going to start in middle school and track where our really great students in middle school, particularly from diverse backgrounds, and support them in having early teaching experiences and working with our higher ed partners so they can get scholarships and they can go on and be teachers and return to our communities or other communities, hopefully in the state. We also know that Senate Bill 755 expanded the definition of the Oregon Minority Teacher Act by including persons who English was not their first language. So we really have to work with the Oregon University System, the Oregon Department of Education, and teacher standards and practice to really figure out what that all means and how to implement it according to the law. One of the parts of their early learning division is really working with our community colleges to make sure we have professional development support for people who want to become early learning educators. So that's another really important initiative. And we're, I think one that is also very exciting is the teacher training programs and what we're going to begin to do, working much closer with teacher training, with higher ed in K-12. So when teachers come out, I like to say they can teach day one like their hair is on fire. That's what we need for every single teacher, given the large class sizes we have and the diversity of needs of our students. So the focus of these programs are going to be on recruitment and selection, clinical practice, hiring and placement, and mentorship and placement. The other thing we are going to do, and this is part of our data system, is that we're really going to look at hiring and retention. We're going to have data to know who's getting hired, how many are getting hired, are we retaining teachers. We really want data supply and demand data, and we want to implement a common performance assessment so when people leave our teacher training programs, we have a real sense of what skills they have. Let's see, I'll just hit a few more as we go forward. I think we all know that the Common Core standards are starting this year. There's a lot of, I would say, excitement and also fear around that. And so what we needed to make sure is that there is powerful staff development to support people in successfully implementing the Common Core. Some of the initiatives that are very exciting is the STEM initiatives, and we do have another staff member who's going to be working with the STEM Council who's here. His name is Mark Lewis, and he's right there. He was an aerospace engineer turned teacher, and he taught for a number of years and then was very active in the STEM initiative in Washington, so we think he brings a lot of expertise. Representative Johnson, I heard he spent some time with you last week going to your schools and looking at your programs. So we're already out in the field, and we plan to do that more. There is also going to be a workplace conditions survey, and what we want to do in that survey is make sure after we place teachers that we get a really good sense of what are people saying in the field about how successful have we been in preparing the kind of teachers who can really successfully teach our students. So, I think this is particularly interesting to this committee is if we want students, all of our students, to reach 40-40-20, then we know for many of our students we need to provide additional opportunities for support and scholarships. So we're going to add 9 Aspire sites. People are very excited about that. For all of us have the opportunity to have had Aspire in our schools, we know how important those are. We also have 3,000 additional awards for Oregon Opportunity Grants, providing great opportunities for our students. And we know with the STEM initiatives that we really also want to focus on students in rural population, on girls, and also taking a look at STEAM in addition to STEM. The last thing is we're really looking forward to working on the Accelerated Learning Committee along with Senator Hass, because we know the more college credits students get in high school, the greater the opportunity that they're going to go on not only to start college but complete college. So with that, I'm going to stop and see if the committee has any questions.
Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Golden, how are we doing on the teacher prep as far as the waiver for No Child Left Behind? Are we making progress in the feds?
Yes.
Thinking we're on the right path now?
Representative Dembro, Vice Chair, Representative Huffman, yes, we are. It's interesting because we've been working with them all along, and they knew that for a year we wanted to continue to do some pilots to make sure when we fully implement we have the best possible program. That was all prearranged, but still, because we didn't complete it this year, even though that was an agreement, it did put us in the sort of warning category. But yes, we're continuing to work with them and don't anticipate any problem in the long run.
Thank you.
Thank you for that question.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Golden, you talked about you're going to monitor teacher leaving and staying and things like that. President Obama's higher education proposal says that the Education Department should track graduation rates, transfer rates, graduates' income, the number of students who earned advanced degrees. Are we going to be doing that, or could you comment on that, please?
Yeah. So Representative Dembro, Representative Winsink, a lot of that has to do with the longitudinal database, but it also has to do with budgeting to outcomes. And as you know, there's going to be a big conversation about that. I think that's an example of budgeting to outcomes, and we're just beginning the deeper conversations about that. But definitely, we do know it's important. You know, we're looking at our achievement compacts much more the outputs as opposed to the inputs. So how many students are graduating?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Golden, for that. So Yamavik supported performance. We had talked about having 10%. Bill put it saying 10%, but some states are doing 90% of their state funded based upon performance. So I hope you'll continue to look at that, and we can move that along.
Absolutely.
And actually, along those lines, that reminds me, Representative, one of the pieces of legislation or I guess it was a budget note at the end, said that before the HEC goes forward with an outcomes-based funding formula change, there would be consultation with the legislature. And to that end, I'd like to put a work group together for us to really get on top of that issue. Rep. Wisnant has indicated he's interested in being part of that.
That's
if
great.
Any of you others are, let me know, and I'll let you know more about that.
Thank
Thanks.
You.
Other questions?
Chair?
Yes, Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. Nancy, you might have mentioned it and I might have missed it, but at what time do you think we would have this longitudinal data system up and running to where it can actually assist us in trying to literally know how a student is doing in a classroom in a school district and to find out where the best work is being done, where the best practices are occurring so that we can share that across the state? Yeah, kind of a rough timeline for having something up and running and at that capacity.
Peter, do you want to come up and answer that question? Okay.
Great, welcome.
This is day one for Peter.
Yes. And Peter, if you could introduce yourself for the record, please.
For the record, Peter Tromba. I'm not sure what my title is, but Representative Dembro, Representative Johnson. To be honest, I think the first step is we're writing a business case, and part of that is going to, I imagine, be like an RFP for vendors to be able to submit solutions that will match the goals of the RFP. And to be honest, I don't know the state regulations around the length of time around RFPs or anything like that. So I'm thinking it's finishing the business case and getting it approved is a winter activity, and then hopefully that RFP gets written and it's a spring, summer-ish, getting the vendor. But I'm got to be honest, I'm guessing.
Okay.
And I don't know how quickly that vendor is then going to be able to
so
put that together.
Potentially within the biennium?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, that helps.
All right.
Okay.
Everybody write that down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank
yes.
you, Nancy.
Yeah.
Yes, Rep. Gallegos.
Yeah, I'm just curious. I mean, I'm all for data-driven decision-making. On the other hand, I'm just curious about how we, and maybe it's part of the task force, to look at how do we really acknowledge and not lose sight of the individual, the uniqueness of the teacher, the personality that the teacher brings to the teaching process, and it doesn't get lost in some sort of aggregate of data that we are looking at. So.
Representative Dembro, Representative Gallegos, I totally agree with you. It's interesting because I always felt like we talk about data, but really what matters is the child and what we're doing
exactly.
for the children or young adults in the case of higher ed. So,
yeah.
You know, we look at the database as the backbone, but not really the core of what we're really doing in terms of the P20 system.
Right. Follow up.
Please.
Yeah, I was just also thinking that in terms of our efforts to include more minority teachers, I mean, I think we need to be sensitive to the cultural differences and what we're trying to do with this. Yeah. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, last question.
One final. Dr. Golden, I came into this business somewhat naive, I think, assuming that K-12 and higher ed communicated.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Seemed like something that should be done. And as we're getting the Common Core underway, Are you confident that, and I will, a disclaimer here, I've had some meetings in the interim with higher ed and am encouraged about some of the conversations that I know are going on. But Common Core in preparation for higher ed and not having the remediation problem that we've heard about, do you think we're on track to alleviate some of that?
Representative Dembro, Representative Hoffman, yes, I do, and I think some of it, I think the regional achievement collaboratives are really going to help with this, and I also think the resources that were put towards professional development are really going to help. Again, I just, having been part of Connected Ed with Lane County, we started talking a lot about Common Core. We looked at one area. We looked at mathematics instruction because that is an area where, you know, there's currently, we have a long way to go to really get all our students there. And we started talking across the continuum, you know, around issues sort of, so the test they take to leave high school is different than the entry test in college, and why should that be, and can't we come up with a common test, and can't we align our curriculum? So we really are counting on the regional achievement collaboratives. I should say one part of the collaboratives is that one person from every collaborative is going to come together like into sort of a learning community, so they're all talking to each other and sharing across collaboratives what's really working. And then in addition to that, they're also, their job is to break any of the barriers that are there. And I think, of course, great example is the Eastern Promise. Mm-hmm. They've been able to, and I know the resources were given to replicate the Eastern Promise, because they've been able to break that barrier around 11-14 in a way a lot of communities haven't been able to. So we really have something to learn from the Eastern Promise in that way. I'd say Connected Lane County has really focused on is that personal identifier. How do you be able to track students across the continuum, making sure information that needs to be kept confidential is confidential? And then the other, that sort of a model, is all hands raised with their focus on ninth grade. So we do think by working in these collaboratives, we'll be able to have systems talking much more together than they ever have before.
Great. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Chair, could Victoria get that list to Dr. Golden offered it so we can have
sure.
members to the email?
The 12 that have been funded,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Super. We'll get that.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, all three of you. Dr. Golden, I know you'll be at our disposal if we need you again, and just keep up the good work.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, our next topic is the Secretary of State audit on teacher preparation. And Gary, are you coming up alone? Okay, come on. Otherwise, I would have brought the other two up at the same time. Colleagues, while they're setting up, you'll recall at the end of the session, or you know, when we were still meeting, we were having a series of informational hearings. We did have one on teacher preparation in Oregon. We heard Karen Marangel was there, and several people from different schools of education. While that was while we were doing that, the audit division was looking at this issue and examining how effective our teacher preparation programs are, how they could be improved, and how they could perhaps better coordinate with K-12. So how's that for a lead-in, Gary?
Thank you, Chair Dembro. Yeah. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gary Blackmer. I'm the director of the Secretary of State Audits Division. With me is Andrew Love, who is the principal auditor in charge of this audit. And it was a nice introduction for Dr. Golden, because we're going to be focusing on the upper right corner of her handout there that basically talked about teacher development. And this is where we focused in. And again, I think the goal of OEIB is to treat the system as a continuum for the students, and we were looking at places where there could be better connections. And from our standpoint, we wondered about the connections that need to happen in terms of a teacher succeeding. And so this was actually a pretty broad-scoped audit in that it involved Oregon Department of Education, teacher standards and practices, the public teaching colleges, as well as 197 school districts. So we looked across all those different agencies to see what they were doing around teacher development. The objective of our audit was to determine whether state or local actions could be taken to improve preparation and professional development for beginning teachers. And we wanted to look at ways to strengthen student-teacher practices, increase confidence in Oregon teaching colleges and their graduates, and also improve the professional opportunities that the school districts provide. Because we recognized that it wasn't, you know, the idea of a teacher showing up on day one with her or his hair on fire requires that there be support ongoing as well for a couple years in the school districts as they meet new challenges and have their professional development. So we were pleased to see that Oregon had already taken some initiatives in this area. They had adopted the new recommendations, the National Council for Accreditation of Teacher Education, which had a wide range of recommendations, and we focused on the four, which had to do with expanded student teaching experiences, which is called clinical practice, but it's really getting the students out into the classrooms where they will be teaching earlier in their education, so that they can bring back the experience and observations watching those students, participating with those students to the classroom and the college faculty in order to kind of strengthen their knowledge and growth. Also looking at teacher preparation in terms of a partnership between the teaching colleges and the school districts. That we were looking at the training and the qualified staff that were provided, as well as the coaching teachers in the universities as well as in the school districts, and also looking to encourage teaching colleges to work with school districts to develop new standards or new rewards and incentives for the coaching teachers as well as the teaching staff. So these are some of the key findings we had, which were that we found that Oregon's public teaching colleges can do more to strengthen student teaching. Essentially, we found quite a bit of variance among the different teaching colleges in terms of what they were doing and implementing these recommendations. And to their credit, these are relatively new recommendations, so we didn't expect them all to be completed, but we wanted to just try to give a quick snapshot of where they had gone. So we interviewed the deans and faculty of the teaching colleges to get a sense of it. So I'm not going to walk through this whole chart. It's in our audit, which is on our website. But what you see is just looking across, the different teaching colleges are on the right-hand side of the chart there. And black means that they have been essentially fully implemented in a comprehensive way. Clear means they haven't started work on it. And the others are stages in between. And what you can see is some are farther along on some of the tasks than others. So from our standpoint, we saw good progress, but we also see a lot more that needed to be done. And we also want to call out some of the challenges that they were already encountering. So one of the things that we thought would be real useful would be to start developing some more indicators around performance to help the school districts make decisions around the graduates that are coming out so that they can get a better sense of the teaching colleges themselves. We found that there was a mixed kind of a satisfaction with the students that were coming out. And in fact, this is a question we asked. We sent a survey out to all 197 school districts to ask them a number of questions, and this one being, do you believe that Oregon's public teaching colleges do a sufficient job in preparing teacher candidates for their teaching assignment? We got about half the school districts responding, and of those half, 40 said yes, 51% no, and 10% don't know. Now, these are not necessarily saying that every teacher coming out of there is not good, or it's not an objective measure, it's a perception. But from our standpoint, this is one of those connections that we think can be strengthened, where there's more dialogue going on between the school districts and the teaching colleges on what what they're getting in terms of graduates and what the strengths and weaknesses are of those graduates so that the teaching can be improved and can better match up with ultimately the employer and the students out there in the classrooms.
Excuse me, Gary.
Sure.
Do you mind questions as we go along?
Not at all, Chair Denbrough.
So, first of all, I wonder if we could have copies of all the questions that were asked. How many were asked of the superintendents?
I have my expert.
Thank you. Oh, and could you introduce yourself, please?
For the record, my name is Andrew Love, and I'm principal auditor with the Secretary of State, Chair Denbrough. We asked, the focus of the survey was mainly on professional development, and so there was quite a few questions in terms of what their systems look like. We included, I guess, by the request of some of the superintendents where we tested the survey out, they strongly suggested that we included several questions regarding the education piece, and so there was specifically about 5 or 6 questions around that area. Does that answer your question?
It does, yes. Okay. And I look forward to seeing copies of them and the results. One of the questions I have is, was there a question, here you're asking about the public teaching colleges, was there a question about how satisfied they are with the private teaching colleges? I mean, do we have a sense of one versus the other?
Chair Denbrough, the scope of our authority addresses public institutions, and so we really felt uncomfortable about asking the same question of the private teaching colleges, just because we knew that that would not be an area that we got into in terms of audit recommendations in a specific way. So we felt like we needed to stick within state institutions as opposed to getting into the private, and it ultimately raises questions about teachers coming from other states as well.
Yeah, no, I understand that, but personally, I would like to know how we're doing, our public colleges versus the privates. Are we doing better? Are we doing worse? Are there best practices in the one sector? That's all, I think, useful information in order to put this in perspective.
Chair Denbrough, I agree, and I think that's something that certainly the universities and the Oregon Department of Education and so forth can explore when they consider doing something like this in the future.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir, please.
Mr. Love, I was curious, if you asked that question, did you get any information with regard to where they saw the teachers lacking or where there were insufficiencies?
Chair, Representative Denbrough, Representative Gallegos. We did not actually inquire into why that was perception. I mentioned before that the purpose of the survey was really to talk about professional development opportunities at the school district level. But we saw an outcry for that question, and we asked it, and that was the response we got. And so the purpose was really to point out a perception issue, not necessarily the truth behind that, because it's subjective in terms of how superintendents rate the universities, and we really didn't want to go down that road, but we did want to point out the perception that may exist.
Thank you.
We believe that more specific information, like the survey, like some indicators such as how employed teachers are 4 or 5 years in the future, could help give a broader sense of how well the teaching colleges are doing, as well as kind of an expectation from the school districts on what kinds of teachers are coming out of those colleges. But I also want to emphasize that there are limitations in any kind of a performance measurement system, and that we look at measures as indicators. They're not necessarily determining an outcome. And we're looking at measures as a way to help inform decision making, because we look at every school district as a real different kind of a challenge for teachers, looking at each different grade level as different kinds of challenges. So I think we need to approach these measures cautiously to help inform decisions, but not to determine decisions. So that's kind of one of the things we wanted to emphasize, that we think that especially when you're trying to evaluate a teaching college and looking at student outcomes, which are three or four levels removed from what that faculty member or student teaching or student coach is doing 4 or 5 years earlier, makes it a little tenuous in terms of being able to absolutely determine it. But we do think that it's important to have those measures to help with decision making. What we found was only 3 of the 6 public teaching colleges regularly provide any kind of information on their graduates after they enter the workforce. Other states track things like hiring retention data. They're surveying their graduates and their employers, developing or measuring student growth that they can hopefully attribute back to the teaching college graduates, and then summarizing the results of teacher evaluations conducted by the graduates' principals in their new place of employment. We also saw, in looking at the teacher standards and practices area, that they depend upon the teaching colleges to provide the final assessment of that student in order to grant them a license. And other states are starting to explore a more independent assessment, meaning that a student goes through a teaching college, they graduate, they apply for a teaching license, and the teacher standards and practices essentially relies upon that teaching college to certify whether that student is qualified to be a teacher. And from our standpoint, we're always looking for independence and objectivity in it, and we think that there may be some value in enhancing the assessment process by having a video that the teacher provides as part of the portfolio, but also to have an independent assessment. And states like Washington, Wisconsin, and New York are looking at that. The other key area is expanding professional development support for beginning teachers. This is a place where teachers need a lot of support over a number of years by the superintendents, especially the first 3 to 5 years where they're encountering situations they might not necessarily be prepared for, and having high-quality mentors, having ongoing learning opportunities to kind of layer their professional development, and also developing basically some kind of performance evaluation process that encourages growth and development and helps them assess how they're making progress in their career. So what we found is some Oregon school districts provide professional development and support, while others do face challenges. In that survey, we found that of the school districts, the question, does your school district have written policies, plans, or procedures that beginning teachers participate in a mentoring program? Only 38% said yes. 38 of the respondents said yes, 67 said no, and 4 said don't know. So we found quite a bit of variety in terms of those new teachers and what they encounter when they start their first job in the classroom. So what we found was that the current funding supports only a small proportion of the school districts. Only 17 of the 197 participated in the mentorship program. And the key is this is not necessarily only, say, an extra stipend for a teacher. It's really more around if you want your best teachers to be mentors, you need to take them out of their classroom and into your new hire teacher classroom to observe, to take time to work with them, and someone needs to be with those other students. So there isn't an easy way for school districts, especially small ones, to be able to pull teachers out without a replacement. So to the degree that this is a challenge that the school districts face on the mentorship side is really critical. There is recent establishment of the Network of Quality Teaching and Learning provides some additional funding for beginning teacher and administrator mentorship, but again, it's just the start. So some of the key recommendations that we came up with in the audit were to develop standards and guidelines for professional development, address professional development funding for the mentoring side of it, identifying and offering professional development, and providing professional development for school districts in remote areas, which is one of the big challenges that we saw. Was it's a lot easier for teaching colleges to partner with a school district nearby because there's a lot of back and forth from the student to the classroom. That's kind of the expectation. But in rural areas, it's more difficult for those student teachers to be able to have easy, quick access to a schoolroom and then come back to their teaching college. So other recommendations: help school districts offer meaningful professional development aligned with the model core teaching standards, help create teacher evaluation systems, and gather and report on the effectiveness of graduates of Oregon's public teaching colleges. For the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, we recommended requiring an independent performance assessment of teacher candidates, adding a video component to the work sample. And I would encourage you, all of our audits are on our website, and this one is, as I say, a very large audit because it covered many areas, and I gave you a very quick little synopsis of kind of the key findings and recommendations from it. So we're happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
That was very good. Thank you, Gary. Rip Davis.
Thank you very much for this presentation. Both presentations put me in mind of where I was in 1974-75. I was hired by the University of Oregon to supervise a teacher corps program that was specifically designed to, I was outstationed at Mount Angel College at the time and directing a bilingual, bicultural, Latino cohort of student teachers. And we were placing those teachers, student teachers, into the Woodburn School District. And I think that was 40 years ago, and even now the dropout rate for Latinos is still about 50%. They're not getting out of high school. And I just think that, you know, that's going to be another, I don't think I'll be here another 40 years to see the changes. I guess my point is simply I'm really anxious and wondering why it's still the way it is. Demographics in Oregon, the communities of color have increased to such an extent. I'm just very concerned about it, and I don't see a lot of discussion about how we're going to really stop talking about that problem and really deal with it. And that may be, Mr. Chairman, a discussion then for another specific hearing to really look at this issue and see what we need to do to stop talking about it but do something.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Chair, yes. Chair Demereaux, Representative Gallegos, it's very much a current concern for us also, and we've actually, we have embarked on an audit, what we're kind of shorthand calling the achievement gap, and we're looking at the disparity of achievement in all the school districts. It's something that Oregon Department of Education was very interested in when we brought the idea to them, so I'm hoping that maybe next spring we'll be able to see some places where there is success going on and
great.
Be able to capitalize that in other districts.
I have a question. One of the the themes that runs throughout is the challenges of making these changes in a climate where there's not a lot of money to put into it, not a lot of funding. Do you have a recommendation about whatever funding we're able to provide, how best we should be providing it? Should it be dedicated programmatic funding for this purpose, or should it be directed to the institutions and then have expectations that they will use it well and rise to the occasion?
Chair Denbrough, that's a great question. I don't know that I have the right answer there because I think it depends. It can vary district to district. Some of them, the idea that this is a top priority for school districts as opposed to reducing class size is a hard trade-off decision that needs to be made. And I don't know that there's one model that works better than another. I think from our standpoint, we saw that for this initiative to succeed, it needs more money. So I guess the commitment that is out there is based upon the idea that there will be resources to adequately fund some mentoring programs and to look at ways that, you know, the teaching colleges can partner with the school districts. And there's some good examples around the state where there is really close partnerships between, I think, Salem Kaiser and, what was it, Willamette?
Willamette,
yes. Unfortunately, I believe they discontinued their teaching program, but they literally had observational classrooms with where students could watch, you know, good teachers teach. Those kinds of things can add a huge amount of value to a student teacher's development, but whether that can be affordable for all school districts or even some of them close to universities is another challenge. So I guess the one thing I would say was that we think the costs are a little easier to understand in the K through 12 system for bringing teachers in and covering, you know, the mentoring program. On the teaching college side, our recommendation did ask the teaching colleges to develop a cost estimate of their current costs and then an estimate of what the additional costs would be so that we have some handle on what the increment would be on that side of it, which is the other cost element.
Great, thanks. Yeah. Rep Gorsuch.
Just really quickly, did the audit look at community college programs like early childhood education teacher programs?
Chair Dembrough, Representative Gorsuch, no, not in this case. That was outside the scope of what we looked at.
Because that would seem to me to be an important component to the overall discussion. I'm curious as to why that was left out.
Chair Dembrough, Representative Gorsuch, I guess one of the ironies of this is when we went in, we were auditing in the university system, they talked about the fact that the students coming in were more challenging in terms of needing remedial reading or math or things like that. And it occurred to us that they actually own some of that problem in terms of their training the teachers to be preparing the students to come to the university. So, and I think there are more contributors to that, like community colleges. And we had to draw a scope somewhere, and the 17 community colleges would have been, I think my team would have probably collapsed under the weight of this audit otherwise.
Understandable. Thank you.
They do their work very lightly. But I think that's a very good point, and I think that's a good subject for a future hearing. Is the role that community colleges play in teacher preparation. We had a session on where the Portland Teachers Program, you know, which works with trying to increase the number of minority teachers, talked to us. But it's definitely something I think worth pursuing. Rep. Lisnett, and we'll make this the last question for this session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Only 17 of the 197 school districts participated, and that was strictly because it was a competition to give it to those 17. We had limited funding, or
I do believe. Oh, excuse me, Representative Dembrough, Representative Wisnett. I believe it is a competitive grant, and so that was one of the reasons. And just the funding behind it isn't.
Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, gentlemen. You'll hang around in case questions come up from the responses. Yes, thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, so now I'd like to call up Karen Marangel and Keith Mink to give us the perspective of the university system and teacher standards and practices.
Good morning, Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. Yeah. For the record, my name is Karen Marangel. Yeah. I'm the Interim Vice Chancellor for Academic Strategies with the Oregon University System and a Professor of Mathematics at Portland State University. I'd like to begin by extending our thanks to Mr. Blackmer, Mr. Love, and the audit team for conducting a very balanced assessment of public educator preparation programs in Oregon. The report pointed out strengths and progress while also noting areas for improvement, and you've heard about some of those. The recommendations are in line with the direction that the educator preparation programs are taking in the state, and for that we felt that we had the backing of the findings for the direction that our programs are taking as they're going through revisions and renewal. And although we note that some progress has been slow because some of the activities are difficult or expensive to implement, our educator preparation programs have been building collaborations with school districts for many years. In Dr. Golden's opening remarks today, you heard an example of that in the Springfield School District with their local universities. This is happening all over the state with our institutions, but it is expensive and it does take time. Today, I'd like to make some comments regarding performance indicators, so responding to some of what you saw in the survey outcomes, the teacher performance assessment, the role of external funding and research, and our response to the recommendations that were directed to the Oregon University system. Underlying my comments is the reality that our schools and colleges of education implement many of these recommendations and could do so more fully, but the recommendations require consistent and stable funding. You heard from Mr. Blackmer about other states that have some exemplary programs in place: Ohio, Texas, Tennessee, Florida, New York, Kentucky. These states all fund their efforts consistently and sustainably, and so we also need to address the role of funding in implementing these recommendations. So please feel free to ask questions at any time, of course. I'm going to begin by talking about performance indicators. As you heard from Mr. Blackmer, performance indicators are not a panacea. And we agree that performance indicators, when done well, and if they are of high quality, can help inform and guide decision-making both internally in the schools and colleges of education and for prospective teachers. And we would want to hold our schools and colleges of education accountable for showing how they're using how the results of performance measurement actually show up in changes in their programs. I have some data from Portland State University that will show exactly how complicated this is. So you saw a presentation from Mr. Blackmer on the results of the survey that they conducted. In 2007, Portland State conducted a survey, both a quantitative survey and a qualitative follow-up, of 51 administrators who employ Portland State University graduates. So I'm going to give you just one example of one of the results they found, which is quite different from the results that you saw Mr. Blackmer present. When the respondents were asked to rank how whether they agreed or not with the statement, PSU graduates are able to use evidence to solve problems of practice and make informed educational decisions, so this is the crux of teaching, 98% of the respondents said that they agreed or strongly agreed. And in questions like those about how students work with diverse populations, how students can differentiate instruction in the classroom, how students can take on leadership abilities, most of the results were in the 95 or above agree and strongly agree categories. Portland State then went further to interview a select group of the respondents and do some qualitative follow-up on that. Our schools of education want to do this type of analysis. They want to have the data that shows them what it is that the school districts think about their employees and where they can make improvements. But that was in 2007. Budgets were cut. This was one of the activities that unfortunately was cut. I'm not going to go into, though I could, some of the other tricky aspects of how we conduct surveys. But to do it well takes stable, consistent funding, and that's the bottom line.
Can I just jump in? Mm-hmm. Could we get a copy of that report, the survey that was done in 2007?
Yes, Chair Debrow, I'm happy to supply that to you. As the audit pointed out, and as some of you raised, we do not know the reasons for the administrators' dissatisfaction with teachers prepared at Oregon's public educator preparation programs, but we'd want to know the reasons why so that we can make improvements. I can update you that the Oregon Association of Colleges of Teacher Education, OACTE, and this is a group that works with the public and private schools and colleges of education, has recently contracted with a research firm to conduct alumni and employer surveys for all of the Oregon public and private schools and colleges of education. We agree with the audit report's findings that the results of the survey, once administered, should be easily available to the public, including how the results have been implemented or how they have resulted in program changes in the schools and colleges of education. So we are making some progress on that front, and that's being funded by the schools and colleges of education. any teacher preparation program in the Oregon University system would jump at the chance to be able to track our graduate success once in the classroom and understand any trends that help us deliver more effective programming. This would be a perfect area for some increased and stable funding in the future. I'll pause here for questions, and if there are no questions, I'll move on to the teacher performance assessment.
Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Karen, I'm just going to push back a little bit about your repeated iterations about stable funding and so forth. And I guess from the perspective of that, you know, if I'm a department head of whether it's math, science, teacher prep or whatever, part of what I'm in charge of doing is making sure that what we're engaged in is relevant and it's up to speed and so forth based on just what I do, not relying upon extracurricular funding that should come in over and above what I normally have to work with. Now, on the one hand, I understand in the K-12 world where we've got school districts that literally are doing everything they can do to keep the doors open, to try to have a school year that's academically as long as it can be, keep kids there and so forth. So to ask them to go over and above, provide professional development opportunities, one thing. But I guess if I'm just talking about is preparing, again, from the students, from the professors or from the department head standpoint, it seems to me that you're constantly in that process of updating and modernizing as you come. Science changes, things happen, you have to update curriculums and teaching. So respond if you would.
Chair Dembro, Representative Johnson, that's a great question. Thank you for it. You're right. Because at universities we are also scholars, we are constantly, we're at the forefront of new knowledge and bringing new thinking into the classes that we teach. And so that is a part of what we do. Where there can be a disconnect is understanding if what we're implementing is actually making a difference to the teachers who are going into the classroom. So are we making them better prepared to teach on day one? And that requires typically a dedicated person who's working with the school districts to understand that you know, what are the needs, what are the changing needs out in the districts. So while a lot of our faculty have some hand in the school districts, they're not required to be there, and certainly not in the disciplinary departments. So more so in the schools of ed, but even in the schools of ed, it depends on their research, depends on their service load. They may or may not be in the schools on a daily basis to really understand what the environments are like. And so how do you get that information transmitted back to the colleges of education and the disciplinary departments? You typically need staff time to go out, to understand what's happening, to bring back information to help implement program changes. I can give you examples. At Southern Oregon, they had a great partnership with some of their school districts in the Ashland area because of budget cuts. They weren't going to cut staff and faculty who are teaching the classes, so the first positions to go were the outreach to the school districts. So while it's probably not as dire as the conditions in K-12, we still feel the pressures of budget cuts.
And I will add that this, you know, the challenges of tracking students after they graduate is not limited to the field of education. I think that's something that we're seeing as a real national challenge. And you know, the president has called, you know, as was mentioned earlier, has called for us to do better tracking of the success of graduates, where they end up working, and I think everyone agrees with that. But how we get there are a lot of impediments to getting there. I think arguably the field of education, maybe that's going to be a little easier because we're dealing with, you know, we know our 197 school districts, you know, for those students who stay in state. Maybe it'll be, and we have the teachers, the TSPC, which also tracks. It may be a little easier there, but it's a general challenge. Please continue.
Okay. So I'd like to address a few comments to the teacher performance assessment. Currently, Oregon has a teacher performance assessment, the teacher work sample, and it's been around for quite some time. And it provides a common assessment tool that enables us to have a view of the effectiveness of teacher programs across the state, though it hasn't quite worked in that way. And all of the OUS campuses are committed to using it. Could it be improved? Absolutely. But it's a good base tool that we're working effectively and collaboratively on to advance within the programs. In the audit report, the auditors talk about the EdTPA, which is similar to the work sample and has been marketed and is being used nationwide. And I've had extensive conversations with our deans and directors of the teacher education programs, and they feel very strongly about it. There are certainly advantages to that type of independent evaluation, but there are also some important limitations, and I just want to outline a few of those for you. One of the most critical pieces of feedback that I get from the deans and directors is that the information gathered from a tool like the EdTPA, because it is external to the school and it is independent, doesn't provide immediate or timely feedback to candidates that the college supervisors would use to help provide program improvement or help provide improvement for the individual students. And so it sets up just an extra barrier of trying to get that information fed back into the colleges in a timely manner. A second concern is that high-stakes independent evaluation means that the candidate has no opportunity to revise their work sample. And so once it's submitted, it's a pass or fail situation. And if a student fails, then just the time it would take to go through recourse and grievance would add up. And so there's lots of questions associated with this. Would a student teacher have to redo their student teaching experience in order to develop a new work sample, et cetera? So there are some impediments that we would want to work out. And then, of course, there's the sharing of digital work samples with independent evaluators. So we need to assure that the criteria of the quality of those videos would be able to be met by students at any income level. And then emerging evidence from those who have had experience piloting the EdTPA, they felt that there were concerns about it as a quality evaluation tool, and certainly in the research literature there's already starting to bubble up some negative effects of turning teacher preparation programs into focusing on passing the EdTPA and advocating for a more value-free approach that could undermine some of the social justice approaches to education and teacher prep programs. So those are kind of a summary of the comments from the deans and directors about their concerns with the EdTPA. And again, I'll pause here. I'm happy to answer any specific questions you might have.
Yes, Rick.
Just a quick one. Do you think we're getting to the point then, after hearing the audit and the response, do you think teacher education is getting to the point of where we are in many other disciplines, whether it be nursing or medicine or whatever, where clinicals are a mandated part of the curriculum? Do you think we're getting there where we realize that teacher education is a necessary and mandated part of preparing somebody to teach?
Chair Dembro and Representative Huffman, yes, and it has been a mandated part of the teacher preparation programs. What we're working on now is lengthening it. So Keith can speak more clearly to the current mandates, but many of our programs are going above and beyond because they recognize the value of getting future teachers into the classroom early and in a longer period of time.
So just, you know, again, with the question of the EdTPA versus doing it in-house, so it sounds as if your preference would be to continue to do it in-house, but presumably with some sort of quality oversight, right? You know, some kind of auditing, if I could use that word, from time to time as to, you know, to see is this working, and where it's not, then perhaps some interventions could happen at the schools, you know, to make sure that they haven't drifted away from really objectively seeing when the students are not making the grade.
Chair Dembro, yes, that is exactly what we're going after. So again, the Oregon Association of Colleges of Teacher Education are working together to strengthen the work sample and in areas of validity, reliability, and looking at how more independent oversight can be brought into that process. And we know we have work to do, but what's compelling for me is that unanimously the schools and colleges of education are committed to the teacher work sample as the base for the work going forward.
Okay, Keith.
All right. Thank you, Chair Dembro. Committee members, good morning. For the record, my name is Keith Mink. I'm the Deputy Director for the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, and one of my primary responsibilities is to work with the education preparation programs within the state and the whole accreditation process. I'll try and keep my comments brief because I know time's always a consideration. I'd like to thank the audit team for the audit. I think the information they provided was very valuable. It's always good to get feedback, and this is part of what we've been talking about from the commission standpoint as we move in our rules and statute rules around continuous improvement, moving away from compliance. And I want to say that we really appreciated the openness of the ongoing conversation as the audit was progressing, if they had questions, if we had questions, and so we really appreciated it. The information they provided really reaffirmed the areas that the commission was working on, and so that was gratifying for us. We also recognize that we need to continue to improve in a lot of these areas. And I want to spend a little bit of time. Over the last two or three years, the commission has made a concerted effort to move from a compliance model, which is checking for just flat compliance to rules around accreditation, to one of continuous improvement. And that means a whole culture shift within the commission and within the education preparation programs, not only in the public institutions, but the private institutions. We're really asking them to demonstrate through data that they're producing quality candidates. And one of the things that we put into place is through accreditation is peer review, where peers now look at the assessments, look at the rubrics, the scoring guides, look at the data to make sure that what they are producing really helps them in their ongoing continuous improvement and use of that data. We're doing this at the program level, as an example, in ed leadership or the special ed programs, all the way across to the whole unit in both public and private. And I have to say that our stakeholders, both public and private, have joined in and been very supportive of this and working with us at coming up with consensus around how to do this. And I believe that we've made great strides in that area. It really is a commitment by the institutions and also the commission to continue this work. And so with the results of the audit being presented to the commission's committed to following through and developing a statewide teacher performance assessment, whether it is the proposal that is being put together by the Oregon Association of Colleges of Teacher Ed or even considering outside teacher performance assessment. The commission is committed to having a valid and reliable performance assessment. They're also committed to looking at the policies and rules that we have in place now that may be barriers to better clinical practice. We do have established for years a requirement of a minimum of 15 weeks of clinical practice in the schools, but we're examining our policies and our rules to make sure that we're not by some reason limiting the ability of programs and candidates to get more engaged for a full year clinical practice or using other models such as co-teaching. We're also committed to developing statewide with work from our partners, stakeholders, and the education preparation programs to developing statewide accountability measures and following through so that we have some ongoing indicators, if you will, of performance that can be helpful to not only school districts but also the preparation programs on how well they're doing. We're always conscious when we're talking about teacher performance assessments or accountability measures to always be certain about how we're going to use the data. And there's always some built-in concerns about the use of data. When you look at the teacher performance assessments used for years in the state of California, they're very specific about how the data from those instruments are to be used. And that really is to be used as part of multiple measures to be fed back to the candidates and programs for continuous improvement. And so we want to make sure as we go and develop these systems with teacher performance assessment, testing data, survey data, and possibly other accountability measures, that it is data that is used for continuous improvement and to feed back to the programs and to the candidates. The commission is also committed to meeting the needs of the school districts, and we've been working with several different school district groups around identified needs of that the candidates coming out of the programs, the competencies that they need to be effective with the classrooms that we have today and we anticipate to have in the future. And so we've been working very closely with them around competencies related to English language learners, to dual language and immersion programs, and the commission will continue to work with districts and respond to those needs. And I'll stop there, and if anyone has any questions.
Okay, thank you very much, Keith. That was very helpful. Karen, any final comments you want to make?
No.
Okay.
I would comment. I do look forward to seeing the actual study, and certainly I just would mention that certainly as a former university administrator, I always had not always kind words for the accreditation folks, but I do want to say that you know, your business about not just meeting minimum standards. I mean, it seems to me that's what accreditation was about. You know, what are the minimum standards that you have to meet to have an accredited program? But rather, how do we really exceed those, and not really accreditation not being the driver, but excellence really being the driver. And so you're right, you know, changing that culture and really getting that message out would be great. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you both. And thank you, both of you from the Audit Division. This is obviously a subject that we will continue to be tracking. It is, you know, as I mentioned before, it's a national conversation, and we'll be keeping an eye on what's going on in the other states as well. And thank you again. Okay, now it's my pleasure to call up Gerald Hamilton, please, to give us a brief report on what's going on at in our community colleges. And colleagues, some of you will remember Gerald from his, I think the last time he appeared before us, he was speaking about credit for prior learning. As a former community college president and member of the State Board of Ed, now he is with us in a different role.
So, well, good morning. So thank you, Chair Dembrough and members of the committee. It is a unique pleasure for me to be sitting here today representing CCWD after being involved in the community college system for long and believing deeply in that mission. It was a very quick decision to come out of retirement and be able to forward that mission. CCW, getting to the topics.
If I can butt in.
Oh, I'm sorry.
If you could just introduce yourself for the
record. I apologize. My name is Gerald Hamilton, interim director of CCWD. Getting back into where we are with CCWD, it is clearly a time of transition for the department. As you all know, we are moving from under the State Board of Education to the HEC, you know, for our governance structure. And at the same time, the workforce side is looking at some differences in the way we offer our workforce programs. And so with that being said, it was really important to look at some focus for the agency over the next year. So what we've done is we put together a one-year plan. The one-year plan, coincidentally and not surprisingly, coordinates pretty closely with what Dr. Golden was saying earlier. Many of the same things that we are working on, our OAIB issues as well. You know, first I would just talk about our workforce side a little bit. One of the goals we have is to increase our work-ready communities by increasing the numbers of folks within those communities who have taken the National Career Readiness Certificate and passed that. Our goal is to have 100,000 of those by the year 2015. and at the same time increase the numbers of businesses who support that certificate to 2,000. It is a lift, that is, you know, for us. Currently we have 26,600 or so folks who have taken the NCRC and have passed that in some format, and 1,172 businesses that have wrote letters of support. You know, we are currently looking at ways that we can move that to the broader assessment programs. For example, GED. Would it make sense for students as they're going through the GED program to look at an NCRC that really takes them beyond what that GED program does? And I think as we look at those bigger, broader opportunities, that's going to make some sense for us. Secondly, we are working very hard in our sectors program to with our local workforce investment boards to create those partnerships between employers that support the workforce and build that synergy around within sectors about how do we in our local communities how do we improve that workforce. Third, and I'm going to, I know time is an issue today, so I'll go through these fairly quickly. Third, around developmental education. This is one that to me is an incredibly important piece of work. You've heard about this over and over again. Someone said earlier that we continue to talk about it. And what we're trying to do is do a developmental ed initiative that brings people together, that by the end of this year we'll have put some recommendations around policies and practices and curriculum together that will make some difference. I mean, we recognize that that it is an issue where, you know, many statewide we spend 20% of our funding on pre-college programs, and I think there is a lot to be learned on how we offer developmental education programs. How do we organize them? And so I think as we work with stakeholders in this broader sense, can we put together some policies and practices, working with other folks and around DevEd, work with our K-12 partners, recognizing that it is a bit of a lift as well, because if you go to, and those of you that have been in the community colleges for a long time know that if you go into a Math 20 class, the average age is 35 and are wonderful folks but have not taken math for a long time. so there is a lot of work to be done in that area.
Gerald?
Yes, sir.
There's going to be a statewide convocation, isn't there, at some point, about remedial education, developmental ed?
Chair Dambro, I believe so. I don't have a lot of information about that this morning.
Okay, but great.
We are also looking at, not surprisingly, at the K-12 connection. You know, my history as a school superintendent, a college president, says that's really a transition point that we need to work hard on. You know, I've worked with Rob Saxon from ODE on bringing together a superintendent president's group to say how can we as CCWD help the K-12s work with their senior year redesign? How can we bring our instruction to that level, and what are the barriers we can help that break down? It seems to me that the Oregon Transfer Module, which is a 45 credit transfer module, works really well in that situation for a lot of folks. And it's just a matter of us talking about what are those barriers. Is it a credentialing barrier for teachers? Is it, you know, all of those kinds of things, and can we do something about that to help that move that one forward? We also believe that within that, the Career Pathway Program would help us, I think, structure something that at the end is going to be valuable for students. We also, you know, as you know, we're also working with the college presidents on an outcome-based funding model. We are meeting in the next week as the group of presidents to try to get our hands around that some more, and hopefully have a some kind of a notion of where that's going to light very soon. Important work that was started by Cam Preuss last year and continues, although now with a broader group That includes 17 presidents, as you might expect. Other work in the department, I think an exciting opportunity is, you know, many of the schools are in achieving the dream. We have two schools independently, Lane and Lynn Benton. Also, we have a small school consortium that are working with a national group called Achieving the Dream, looking at with data coaches and improvement coaches to do some good work around their improvement. And finally, I would just mention, we're part of our efforts around the Capitol. We're very excited that 16 colleges received their Capitol request in the last session. And for us, that's us putting together the whole package and those bond package. That kind of work progresses on as we speak. So with that, there's lots more, but I'll quit and answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you very much, Gerald. Questions? Okay, well, that sounds great, Gerald. We look forward to you coming back to talk to us about more initiatives as they progress.
We will do that, sir.
And good luck. Thank you for taking on this job.
Thank you very much.
Okay, next up, higher ed governance. Fascinating topic, as we all know. So Ben Cannon is going to give us some updates, what has happened since close of session, and what we can expect over the next year or so.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Ben Cannon, Governor's Education Policy Advisor. Yes, fascinating and engrossing topic, taking up the better part of several of our lives, maybe many of our lives, for the last year or more in some cases. So I am here to speak to really the pretty extraordinary changes that are underway in terms of how Oregon governs higher education, community colleges, and universities since the passage of Senate Bill 270 and House Bill 3120 during the last legislative session. I provided a couple of charts to you and your staff that will be familiar, I think, from session, since we used versions of these to describe the direction that these bills take us. So my intent was to quickly sort of remind you of what has been done in terms of changing governance structures, and then to walk in a little bit more detail through some of the implementation work that's underway since the passage of those bills. But it's your committee, Mr. Chair, and I'm happy for this to be as conversational as you like, and I don't mean to spend any more time on any of this than you expect. So just cut me off when you will.
I just have my eye on Rep. Johnson. I can tell he's going to have a lot of post-traumatic stress.
I was checking to see if I had my Dramamine with me so I can look over this chart.
Yes. Well, there aren't lines or arrows, you'll appreciate, on this simplified version of the charts. And actually, the main thing to note in the previous, this would be sort of the old P20 structure, is the complexity of these dark blue and light blue boxes in particular. A lot of them, and I think the main distinction you get here as we move towards where I'll spend a little more time, the current structure is a much more simplified, streamlined version of governance for our entire P20 system. Focus of this committee, of course, is on higher education, but I'll note the role of the OEIB establishing the strategic direction for our entire P20 system in conjunction with the legislature and the governor. And then in the higher education space, a single commission, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, with a small staff, that's the light blue bar that runs beneath the HEC. Those represent agency staff and oversight responsibilities as of July 1st of 2014 for the two remaining higher education agencies, the Oregon Student Access Commission and CCWD. You'll recall the governor's initial proposal was to pull all of those light blue boxes together and simplify this even further to mirror ODE and its sort of critical role on the left-hand side of the page. But we've left those OSAC and CCWD intact as standalone agencies for now, but with oversight coming from the HEC and its director. Obviously, the major reconfiguration is in the university system. The State Board of Higher Education, as of a year from now, will have authority for just four universities, Western, Eastern, Oregon Tech, and Southern, while PSU, OSU, and U of O have their own institutional boards. No surprises here, I hope. I'm not going to spend any time unless you would like on the kind of executive reporting. This both tries to share some sense of the relationship between the boards and each other, as well as the boards and the executive officers involved. Obviously, a chief ed officer, a deputy superintendent, an executive director of the HEC that have their own responsibilities for other executive officers. This may get to a level of detail that we can come back to if you want. But what I thought I would spend a little bit more time on, since the focus today is really on implementation, is the other presentation. I hope you have a implementation timeline chart. It may be in a different PowerPoint. It looks like it's not here. There we go. So this won't work very well, I'm afraid, for the audience because of this small font. But this really is our working, kind of our roadmap in the executive branch as we attempt to undertake all of what is described in Senate Bill 270 and House Bill 3120 with respect to implementation. And actually, a significant portion of this goes back to Senate Bill 242 in 2011, and that's reflected in some of the gray bars that are current law, 270, 3120. I guess it's all current law now. This was used in the closing days of the session, but different colors representing different bills that put this into motion. So it's sort of starting at the top. Upon passage of the bill, the governor had the authority to appoint a HEC executive director. That process is underway, and I expect an announcement from him before the end of this month on that. We worked, or I should say OSU, worked very quickly to meet its August 1st deadline to notify the governor that it wished to have an institutional board. It did notify the governor, as you're well aware, and as a result, the governor moved forward with recommended appointments to the OSU board as well as the U of O and PSU board, again, on a very aggressive timeline, August 19th. Those appointees were submitted to the Senate and will be heard in the Senate Rules Committee for confirmation this afternoon. On the same timeline, the bill actually prescribed, 3120 described a slightly different timeline, but we used the same timeline for appointing or recommending the appointment of members to the new Higher Education Coordinating Commission. So those are also moving forward for confirmation this week, we hope, in the Senate. I'll shift sort of to the lower part of the diagram, and first note at that top gray arrow, the State Board of Higher Education maintains its authorities for governing and overseeing the public university, a seven-university system, through June 30th of 2014, and that is really the sort of trigger date for the many of the governance changes that Senate Bill 270 and House Bill 3120 establish. So that bar carries forward through the end of June, and on July 1st, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission assumes statewide policy authorities for public universities. But, of course, the governing authorities for the three large universities, PSU, OSU, and U of O, are transferred to their institutional boards. So those boards are appointed now, hopefully confirmed this week, begin to meet, but really only begin to exercise their full authorities on July 1st of 2015. Senate Bill 270 established two committees, one the Special or Joint Committee on University Governance and Operations, a legislative committee. It also has two OEIB members that will meet for the first time tomorrow. That committee is tasked with sort of overseeing a presidential work group on university shared services. That's the second blue bar below the special committee. That presidential work group has begun to meet already to develop recommendations for how administrative services will be shared among the seven public universities and potentially at some point extended to other higher education entities, for example, community colleges. There's been some thought that there might be opportunities over the long term there. That special committee that, again, meets for the first time tomorrow, legislative joint committee, will also be dealing with the question of how the regional and technical universities should be governed over the longer term. The default in 270 is that they would remain governed by the State Board of Higher Education, but there are other possibilities, including the possibility that after March 1st of 2014, the State Board of Higher Ed would approve, upon their request, an institutional board from Eastern, Oregon Tech, Southern, or Western. Shifting slightly to, well, to 3120, I guess, but in the same piece of work, farther down the page, the State Board of Education, as you know, has the statutory authority today for funding allocations to community colleges and establishing rules and program approval for community colleges. That also is maintained through the end of June 2014, but on July 1, 2014, those authorities are transferred to the HEC. Likewise, OSAC maintains its responsibilities through this year ending June 30th, but that too is transferred to the HEC on July 1st of 2014, and the Oregon Student Access Commission, the commission itself, is dissolved. The final bars here represent merely the fact that the HEC continues to oversee the Office of Degree Authorization that it inherited as a result of Senate Bill 242 and the private career schools that it inherited just in July from ODE via Senate Bill 242 as well. So, as you know, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, July 1, 2014, really becomes the sort of one-stop shop for higher education policy setting in Oregon. But it is important to note, and I think hearing a little bit of Karen's presentation on in response to the audit reminded me of just how significant a shift we've made. Because there will not be state agency, at least in the short run, with as much attention and support and oversight, certainly, of our public university system as exists and as we're accustomed to, and I think as this committee is accustomed to having from the Chancellor's office today. The HEC will not govern the universities. The HEC is not the boss of the universities. The HEC will have, as a result of legislative appropriations, a sort of minimal staffing level to do support it in its responsibility to fund or allocate funding to the universities, as well as to approve programs or disapprove programs, review and approve changes to missions of the universities, develop the overarching strategic plan for higher education. But the level of coordination that you've come to expect from the Chancellor's office will reside to some extent in the HEC, but if it's going to continue, will also reside through the cooperation and collaboration of the universities on a voluntary basis in some cases. And perhaps through other entities, including sort of third-party voluntary kind of approach. So that's where I'll leave off and see what I've missed or whether you are just so darn tired of this topic already that we can move on.
Question for Ben. I do have one just to start off, and this is kind of a technical one. So next year, the work will start, I mean, in the spring, the work will start on the proposal for the next budget, right? How do you see that happening during this transitional period, the recommendations that will go into the governor's recommended budget?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, have had some discussion with the universities about this. I think that's where the greatest potential shift is underway, and our expectation is that the universities with their own governing boards will play the leading role this spring in bringing forward their requests, if you will, for the 15-17 budget. Those will be brought forward ultimately to the HEC. The HEC becomes kind of the integrator for the governor, or for the governor's budget, of the higher education budget. But because the 15-17 biennium is one in which the institutional boards will be fully functioning and governing those three universities, I expect that they will be bringing forward the requests for those three institutions, that the Board of Higher Education will be paying particular attention to the other four, that the community college process will look, and OSAC process will look quite similar to the way they have in the past, and that the HEC will, by that point, have enough of a strategic plan in concert with the OEIB to begin to integrate all of that into a single proposal for the governor and ultimately the legislature.
And what do you see as the timeline for that? When the HEC will have to make its recommendation to the governor?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have not yet seen officially a timeline for the development of the governor's recommended budget with precise deadlines, but based on my experience in preparing the 2013-15 governor's recommended budget, those proposals in their first kind of first form would come to the HEC and to the governor as early as June of 2014. Somebody will be shaking their head wildly no if I'm totally wrong on that and behind me, but it began, I mean, there was sort of a first rough shot at this even before the summer of the even numbered year. It becomes more refined and sort of more officially adopted by the boards typically, I think, in August or September of 2014.
Okay, thank you. Rep Corsa.
I have a question. I want to step back to something that you said. You were saying that we're not going to have as much control or power in terms of the way that the state has influenced higher ed in the past. And then you indicated that in some cases we are going to be relying on universities to cooperate. Am I saying that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gorsuch, yes.
Okay.
Yes, especially about the reliance on cooperation. I don't know, I didn't use the words control, but similar ones.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So what is our what's our contingency if cooperation doesn't occur?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gorsuch, very good question. Well, of course, the legislature enjoys, sort of complete authority to require or compel anything that it chooses to compel. And I find, have found that to be a effective sort of backstop, some might say threat. It's not, I think, the university's hope or desire to see the legislature getting deeply in their business, if you will, requiring through statute cooperation. But the legislature can set a very high expectation around cooperation and can suggest that if it fails to occur, they're likely to, as I have suggested on some occasions, that the universities are likely to find legislators introducing bills that would require them to do things that maybe they've historically done through the chancellor's office because they've been asked to and sort of expected to by the Board of Higher Ed, their governing board. I don't want to overplay the point. I raised it because, I mean, I'm struck as we walk through the implementation just how many functions the chancellor's office performs to bring the universities together. A lot of it's a convening power. It's not as if it's a command. Right. They're commanding them, but they do have ultimate authority. So I'm struck by how many functions they perform. I appreciate the amount of testimony and input they've provided to this committee historically, whether through the chancellor, one of the vice chancellors, or others. And I think it should be something that we're all paying attention to. I know the governor is, and when he meets with his proposed appointees to the university boards later today, he will be making that very point, that his expectation is a high level of coordination, and not just with each other, but with community colleges and other parts of the P20 system as well.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. And I think, following up on that, we did say in the legislation that we expect, I forget how it was worded exactly, but we expect many of the standing committees, such as the Provost Council and the Council of Presidents and the Interinstitutional Faculty Senate, we expect them to continue to be meeting, and that's where a lot of the cooperative work does happen. If they don't, then we may need to spell them out, but hopefully we won't need to go down that road. Other questions? Ben, maybe, I hate to bring this up, but could you perhaps say something about the technical and regionals? And, one of the elements that's in the legislation is we did create a path for them to decide or not to seek their own board and a process, and how that fits into this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, under the Senate Bill 270, starting March 1st, I believe, and through June 1st, March 1st, 2014 through June 1st, 2015, the regional technical universities have the ability to request a board from the State Board of Higher Education, and the board has a certain window in which it's required to act on that request. If approved, that board is established under the same sort of terms and conditions and authorities as the boards of U of O, PSU, and OSU. I think them becoming sort of effective July 1st of 2015, or perhaps there's a mechanism for that to happen somewhat sooner. So that's what is in the law. There is, however, as I noted, one of the responsibilities of the Joint Committee on University Governance will be to evaluate and make recommendations relative to governance structure for those universities, including consideration of potential other governing structures, whether that be the default in the bill, what we had at one time loosely called a sort of consortium board where the four are governed by one, or whether there's some other configuration of multiple institutions under a shared board. The state board, the governor has asked the State Board of Higher Education to begin a process to ensure that its decision, should it have a decision to make about those requests for institutional boards, is grounded in really strong evidence about the financial viability of those institutions under that governing arrangement, as well as the likelihood that they will contribute effectively to meeting our state's goals for higher education. So the governor looks forward to working with the Joint Committee and the State Board of Higher Education on a shared approach to resolving that thorny question.
Thank you. Okay, Ben, thank you very much. Colleagues, as Ben indicated, the special Joint Committee, some of us are calling it Governance 2.0 Committee, is meeting tomorrow for the first time. We'll keep you very much abreast on what is going on there. We may or may not have to look at further legislation in February, depending on what they have to recommend, but I promise you'll stay very much abreast of what's going on. Okay. The next item is just an update that I'm going to give on Pay It Forward, and I'm going to stay up here to do that, if you don't mind. Pay It Forward, ultimately, one of the most exciting things to come out of last session, surprisingly so, actually, for me. You may recall, just to take you back to
to the session. July 1st, the Pay It Forward bill passed the second chamber, and ultimately the governor signed it. I will say today is the ceremonial signing for Pay It Forward this afternoon, sometime around 3 o'clock. If any of you want to come and be part of that festivity, I'd encourage you to do that. You'll remember that what House Bill 3472 did was, first of all, it directed the HEC to study and design a potential pilot Pay It Forward program for consideration, to send back to the legislature for consideration in 2015. You know, at the same time, kind of in partnership with that, we passed Senate Joint Resolution 1, which, you know, many of us think of as the treasurer's proposal, which would be a constitutional referral to look at state bonding authority, to extend state bonding authority so that it would not only be allow us to bond for physical infrastructure, but for human infrastructure, which could be a potential funding source for any pilots that came out. The election for that will be November of 2014. We'll see how that goes. You'll remember that 3472 also included, in fact, the bill in it, as it was proposed, focused on the Western Oregon promise, the freezing of tuition, having the first year tuition be a little higher, but then it would be guaranteed for all 4 years, and looking at perhaps extending that to other universities. That's also something that's on the HEC's work plan to look at the viability of that. So that all passed on July 1st, and even before the session ended, the word about Pay It Forward exploded on the airwaves and the media around the country. This was my first experience with an issue going viral, and I personally was kind of looking forward to July being a quiet month, and you know, I just teach my classes and, you know, not have to worry about this stuff. But a day didn't go by where I, you know, or Victoria, or Rep. Wisnan, I think, you know, was contacted by media, by other states, by legislators, wondering, what the heck is this thing? This sounds very, very interesting. And, you know, there was coverage, you know, in print, radio and television, and, you know, even interest in the Obama administration. The governor was contacted by Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education, asking for more information about it. You know, I think that, the reason for interest at such magnitude was, you know, for various reasons. I mean, I think the primary one is, as we all know, as we spent so much time during the session talking about, we're kind of at a tipping point here in this country in terms of the question of affordability and the huge burden that student debt is placing on students and their families, to the point that people are being scared off of investing in higher ed. And so there's a lot of interest in the issue. I think, you know, and based on the conversations I had with interviewers, there was also a lot of the appeal of the genesis of the Pay It Forward proposal from those students at Portland State University, that this was something that kind of had its birth in students, and, you know, they came to us and, you know, lobbied us, and, you know, ultimately the bill passed unanimously in both chambers. You know, quite a remarkable thing. I will say, though, that I think there was some misunderstanding of the scope of the bill. You know, I think one of the early headlines, or some of the early headlines, said, you know, Oregon decides on free tuition. or no more tuition in Oregon, or, you know, things like that. Of course, if you read the articles, you would they were generally pretty honest and accurate in what they were, how they were describing the program. But, you know, why pass up a good headline if you don't have to? And that, I think, also helped things to go viral. You know, and so as we were talking to people from other states and the media, we had to, did have to clarify that, you know, we are not putting this into place immediately, that, you know, the process will be that the HEC will come up with a pilot, and it will still have to come to the state, to the legislature. We need to do our due diligence. This is a very exciting proposal, but, you know, obviously we need to make sure that everything will pencil out. Just want to tell you some of the ongoing work that's happened since the passage of the bill. There is interest in federal legislation that would parallel what we're doing here in Oregon. Senator Merkley has crafted a bill together with three or four or five other senators that would, it's being called the Guaranteed College Affordability Act of 2013. And it will involve a study by the Federal Department of Education, funding for state pilots like us, like ours, will help with that. It will. It calls for a role to be played by the Internal Revenue Service in guaranteeing collections. You know, one of the issues that came up was, you know, what happens if an Oregon student leaves the state? Will we not have challenges collecting from them? And, you know, we may. You know, I think that's something the HEC will look at. And so if we can have a partnership with the IRS to deal with that in the same way that the IRS deals with, you know, deadbeat dads or that kind of thing, that, that could be useful. There is also an element in the bill that would clarify that students who are part of a pay-it-forward pilot would still be eligible for Pell Grants and other federal financial aid. You know, there was concern about that because tuition is a significant expense for students, but it's not the only expense. And so they may still need the benefit of Pell Grants. So that's part of the bill. And also a part, you know, that's very important to me, I think, to all of us, is that there be a maintenance of effort component to the bill so that states can't use pay it forward in order to just shift more of the burden off onto students, that states need to at least maintain their share of funding college operations. So that's also an important element. Legislators in other states are considering legislation in their states, and by now actually some may have been introduced already. Those states include Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Maine, Indiana, Ohio, California, Illinois, Maryland, Texas, Vermont, and Washington. Some of the Washington legislators think they're going to leapfrog us in this process and get to the finish line before us, I certainly encourage them to try. We've had a number of conference calls and group emails, you know, this work is, you know, I think, going nationwide, and that will be important if the federal legislation is to be adopted, that there be pressure coming from the states to work on this. There have been a group of people, a kind of rump advisory group, to come up with some recommendations to the HEC as the HEC starts its work. The new HEC will have its first meeting, I think, early in October, and so this group has been meeting in order to look at some suggestions in terms of what the pilots might look like. And this group includes students from the original Portland State University class. the treasurers and the teachers of that class, the treasurer's office, Oregon Student Association, the Seattle think tank. You may recall John Burbank from the Economic Opportunity Institute came and talked to us and first presented the information. The Oregon Center for Public Policy, a member of the new HEC is going to be part of that group. And then I've been involved. So, you know, some of the questions that have come up is, you know, not surprisingly, these are things that we've heard, we even heard during our hearings. So what might a pilot look like? Will we focus on one school or, you know, maybe one university, one community college? Would it make more sense to have it spread out so that we have a certain number of slots at each university and community college? Do we want to focus some of these on particular majors? You know, engineering has been talked about, or one of the health professions, perhaps nurse practitioners, or something along those lines. Questions like how do we deal with students who are co-enrolled at a community college and a university, or at multiple institutions, how would they be counted? Anyway, the hope is to present some recommendations to the new HEC when they first meet in October, and as the HEC decides on its work plan. I just want to say that I've had a chance to talk about this at Council of State Governments West and at WICHE, and everybody has questions about it. Everybody, of course, sees potential obstacles for us doing this, but everybody really is deeply appreciative of what we're trying to do here in Oregon, that we're trying to come up with creative ways of dealing with this serious challenge. And, I know I've heard from a lot of constituents not really knowing much about what's being proposed, but just that they appreciate that we're taking it seriously. I'm really glad that we are. I really, want to thank again the students and all the activists who first brought this to us. And I look forward to their engagement. So I'd be happy to answer any questions or any thoughts that you all have as we move forward with this.
I'd just like to say that I was at the initial meeting there at Portland State when the students presented the idea, the concept. And I mean, it's really rewarding to see that concept go from that presentation to actually this fruition. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that is, again, one of the great stories here is that, students can analyze a problem, can come up with recommendations, and actually can help make a difference. We've seen that before with state, crustaceans and, other issues of great, moment. But, this really is something that I think is so important. And having this come from students really, I think, validates it. Yes, Rep. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I just need to add that my state microbe bill last year went viral also.
It was viral from the very beginning, wasn't it? No. No, I'm sorry. It was microbial from the beginning.
Yes, there you go.
Okay, thank you. With that, we'll move on to our final topic, which, we've focused on issues of policy and governance and those kinds of issues. I'm really glad that we're ending today's hearing on a concrete program and one that I think promises great success. This is the Gorge Scholars Program. I'd like to invite up President Toda and Lori. Is it Ufford? Lori Ufford from Columbia Gorge Community College, and want to thank Rep. Johnson for putting this on to our awareness.
Chair Dembrough, for the record, my name is Frank Toda, president of Columbia Gorge Community College. We're thrilled to be here today. The purpose of my remarks, to be very short, is to introduce the college and then introduce Lori Alford, my chief academic and student affairs officer from Columbia Gorge Community College. To begin, Columbia Gorge Community College has this unique mission. We are about building dreams, transforming lives, and making a difference in the communities we serve. And I think if you ask anyone at my institution what our mission is, you get something pretty close to that. We are very, very excited. If you can tell, maybe I'm just vibrating a little bit here. We've been blessed. We just have been blessed with opportunities to serve our community. The Columbia Gorge region, as you know, is an area that is growing leaps and bounds in the area of technology. We have technology companies moving in every day. It's been a challenge to keep up with those activities. Just as backdrop on the college, we are a small rural community college, less than 5,000 students in a community of 15,000. However, we serve 10,000 square miles in five counties. That's a huge area to serve. We leverage technology. Being in a town that Google is located in, we've been able to get huge amount of support for technology offerings at our institution. By way of information and history, our college is one of the newest nursing programs. We were designated by the Department of Labor as a national model for rural health care. Based on that model, we went on and developed a renewable energy training program. We are the first wind tech training program on the West Coast, the first to be congressionally recognized, and the first to be certified by the American Wind Energy Association as a wind tech training college. So our background is we're kind of excited about what we're doing and serving the region, serving the businesses, connecting businesses with outcomes in terms of training programs to put people to work. Our nursing program right now, 100% pass rate, 80% of the RNs coming through that program stay in the region. Our WinTech program, training hundreds of technicians through a 10-month program, also two-year option, 80% pass rate into jobs. And so that's kind of our one of our measures of success. But lately, we were looking for something to do. We just received independent accreditation as a standalone college in July, so that really kicked us into high gear. And so the third focus that we're really doing a full-court press on is how do we build this seamless pre-K through 20 system and make it work in our region. So we are now putting a full-court press on the middle piece of this activity in terms of K-12. And one of the exciting things we developed is a thing called the Regional Center of Innovation. Regional Center of Innovation was just a couple of weeks ago identified as one of the state pilots. So we're really excited about that. And so today, if I don't use up all the time, we want to talk about just one of the things that we're doing, and that is how do we maintain access to the system? How do we make sure that kids coming through the high schools actually have an opportunity to build their dreams and transform their lives? One of the things that Lori has done in the past is been very bold in terms of connecting with the 21 high schools in our region, and we're actually putting counselors into the high school from the college. But that wasn't working, and so we came up with this new program, which I won't talk about, but it is to put that gold ring out there for our students to look at for at all levels. So with that, Lori.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lori Efford. I'm the Chief Academic and Student Services Officer at Columbia Gorge Community College, and I'm here to talk about our Gorge Scholars Program. This program is actually something we've been looking at for quite a while. Chemeketa piloted theirs perhaps 6 years ago, in the less than 10 anyway. What they've seen is remarkable growth in the transition from their high school students into their community college programs and then on to university system. And so as a rural college, we struggle with that. We often see students that immediately choose to go to university and for some reason or another decide that's not for them, and then they spin around for a while until they're 22 or 23 and then come back to college. And so we wanted to make an effort to address that, as well as make it easy and accessible for students to choose the community college as a viable resource for them. So we modeled our program after the Chemeketa program, the Chemeketa Scholars Program. Essentially, in a nutshell, what this program is if you meet the eligibility criteria, which is place college ready and have a cumulative GPA of 3.5, we will offer you full-time tuition waivers for 2 years. So what that means is that you can get in and get out with your associate's degree and pay for your books and tuition. So we feel very honored that we are able to do this. Right now we are also very excited that we are able to offer this to both sides of the river, meaning we offer it to our students in the Oregon schools as well as students that we serve in Washington schools. So in total we have 22 high schools that we are working with. We piloted this very late last year in spring, so many of our students had already decided and chosen and accepted to go to a university. So currently we have around a dozen students who are getting ready to start classes next Monday under this program, and they are very excited, and we are very excited to see them coming to our college. We have, pardon me, we have made this as comprehensive as possible. We are looking at high school students. We are offering this also to homeschooled students, students who choose to join the military right after college, right after high school, are eligible to come back when their tour is done. And as well, we're looking at making some recommendations that we address the ever-growing population of GED students who may fall within the parameters of the eligibility criteria that we have established. So without any further comment on my part, I'd be happy to answer questions if you have any.
Just yes. Comment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'm sure Dr. Tota probably gets eyes rolled and maybe even takes some heat at times, and as if he weren't enthusiastic and creative enough. There is a lot of pressure on Dr. Tota from Rep. Johnson and myself and the communities that we serve, probably weekly meeting with Dr. Tota, either in email form or in person, brainstorming how we can achieve programs like this and pushing for more dual credit and you know, continuing into programs like Gorge Scholars. So it's not all his blame. He gets a lot of pressure from the communities, Gorge Tech Alliance and others, that are constantly trying to brainstorm about how can we do more for our constituents in the Mid-Columbia area. He's always there and creatively thinking, and if we don't have the resources at the state level, in the Dalles area, Wasco County, we've got a community outreach team, and Dr. Tota, Columbia Gorge Community College, Dan Spots is a part of that, and organized 2 trips per year back to D.C., and Frank takes advantage of that to take kind of what we're asking for and mandating and looking for resources outside of what we can come up with and offer either locally or at the state level. So I just appreciate the effort from both of you.
Okay, quickly respond to that. What you can, you're free to object to everything he said.
You know me too well, sir. Thank you for those remarks. I really appreciate it. I failed to mention that one of the reasons we've been blessed is the federal government has been so kind as to put $60 million into our infrastructure in the last 5 years, and that's a huge amount of activity. We're about ready to open up the first national workforce innovations facility in combination with a partnership with the federal government, the National Guard, the Department of Defense, the state, the county, and a city. A perfect example of what can happen when teams work together for collaboration. And again, this Gorge Scholars program is a piece of the Math Golden Thread initiative that we're working on called the Regional Center of Innovation. Again, something that we've been talking about at the federal level and getting some support, albeit not a lot of dollars right now, but we're hoping to get some of those. And again, the future is bright. We're looking forward with how we can move this. And one final point. Again, getting this independent accreditation after a seven-year run was a huge endorsement that we're on the right track. And one of their combinations was the way we've been able to rebuild our organization so that our budgeting and planning system allows us to do things like freeze tuition and give free tuition to our students where they can make a difference. And I failed to mention also that we also encourage dual enrollment. If the high schools reach a certain sliding scale, we actually reduce the percentage or reduce the tuition that they have to pay to take our courses. So we're doing a lot of things in that regard. And again, we wouldn't be able to do them without the support of the legislature and many, many other folks that have been kind to Columbia Gorge. And I thank you for that.
Thank you. Representative has a question.
Mr. Chair, let's see. Dr. President Colonel Toto.
Yes, sir.
You got it. Congratulations, and also thank you for being innovative and trying to help students get higher education. How many students average come from Washington, your community in Washington?
About one-third of our students come from Washington.
And I know we have this in Eastern Oregon, too.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any way, I mean, I think people living in the Oregon communities that you're offering this to, they're paying property tax, which also pays for the community colleges. We need to have an agreement where we look at Washington State and get some of their property tax money, too. So, because that's never been, hasn't been, Oregonians haven't complained or anything about it. One-third of the people we're letting in free are not paying the property taxes, which, you know, you're recognizing with this program.
Yeah, how does that work, Dr.?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, the Columbia Gorge region is kind of unique in the nation. It is the national scenic area, and I am told is the only place, the only national scenic area in the U.S. that allows people to live within it. That's a long way to say that we're all treated as one family, and recently communities of Washington and Oregon began working together in areas of taxes. And in that regard, one of the most significant things that happened is the city of the Dalles, who lives in Oregon, gave half of the airport to Klickitat County. And so Klickitat County and Oregon, Wasco County, actually share in the operations of the regional airport. There are many other things that are going on in that regard, similar, which I'm not smart enough to talk about, but exactly the conversation we're having locally. Yes, sir.
Did you have, was there another?
No. I just had a quick
Okay, Rick Kelly.
Thank you both for being here, and I can see why you're so excited about what's going on. When you come this far, we always want to make sure that you hook up with your representative. I don't know who yours is, but I don't know who represents you up there, but we'd be glad to make sure that you connect with that person, whoever is representing you up there.
So who wants to go next, Rep. Johnson or Rep. Huffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for getting this presentation on the agenda. I'm excited to see how this program is going to play out over the next couple of years as a school board member. Because right now we graduate a significant number, you know, in Hooter Valley High School, significant number of first in family to ever graduate from high school amongst our ELL population. And I'm excited to see how this could be used as a tool to get those students to go beyond just high school completion, but on to post-secondary, because if they haven't graduated from high school, obviously there's no experience in post-secondary. And for some of these families, the concept or the idea of a son or daughter leaving the area to go attend elsewhere can be a daunting prospect. There could be financial hardships for the family, just the unfamiliarity of what that's all about, but if they can stay home and get their associates out of the way, that may be enough for their career path, but it also could very likely be a springboard to something significant for them and for the community. So I'm anxious to see how this can impact that community in particular. And now, finally, we've got the information to get into our Aspire programs in the high school so they can start counseling these students to not just focus on completion, but completion at a certain level, because that opens up all kinds of doors for you afterwards. So I'm excited, and we'll be cheering for you.
Great. Yeah, let me ask a question about just the mechanics. So is this, are these tuition waivers being paid for out of the general fund of CGCC? Have you looked at private philanthropy to help? I know Portland has a program, the Future Connect, which includes some participation from the city and some private business and entities.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have a level of unused capacity right now that we suspect will offset the number of students coming. We intentionally capped in participation this first year so that we could monitor interest and activity. So we capped at 24, knowing that if we needed to add sections, we could absorb that cost. But we do have this unused capacity. Mm-hmm. So we suspect that in the long run, we may end up needing to add certain sections, but feel that that will probably benefit the entire student population. But we'll monitor this year, and that's why we're piloting.
Great. Sounds great. Want to wrap us up?
Yes, a couple of things. One on the tax side, I want to remind folks that in the Gorge area from Klickitat and Skamania counties, we have a number of Washingtonians that work in Oregon and pay payroll taxes, which was a bone of contention when we had the tuition equity bill. Several friends from Washington called me up and said, hey, why can't my child get in-state tuition because I work in Oregon and pay taxes there, and I said, well, that's, you know, it's a valid point and something maybe we need to look at in the future. With the visitation of Dr. Tota to the Capitol also brings with it chocolate-covered cherries, and so on the fourth floor, we have a renewed supply this week.
Yeah,
if
right.
anybody wants to stop by, two offices up there from people that may or may not represent the good doctor.
You've met him before, then.
Okay. I grow cherries, I apologize.
That's an orchard in his spare time.
I had my doubts as to whether I wanted to come here today, to be honest. But now, having heard that, it makes it all worth it.
That's not absolutely.
So thank you both for coming. I have to say, I had the pleasure last week of taking a few days of vacation, and we went east of the mountains, and I think we're in every single city that's on this list in Oregon, and it is such a beautiful part of the state. And but at the same time, it's so far flung, and people have great needs. And it's great to hear that you're coming up with innovative ways of addressing those needs. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, colleagues and members of the public,
an extra cookie here.
unless there are any final questions or suggestions, we are adjourned. We are adjourned.